Reinhardt Glass. You're listening to It's All About Food. I'm looking forward to talking to you today. Got lots of things that I want to share with you. We were just at the 11th annual Veggie Pride Parade in Manhattan. It was a wonderful thing. Just the fact that it's there in a very popular and favorite place in the greatest city in the world. It takes place in Union Square, and there's a lot of traffic through there, which makes it beneficial because people just pass through and they get curious. They go to the different tables, pick up information, chat with people. And for me, it's a selfish thing, actually. It's a moment where I can be with my tribe, with my vegan tribe. We share our accomplishments, we share the things that we've been doing, because so many of us are busy all the time that we don't get to hang with each other. One person that I saw there was Linda Long. I've mentioned her numerous times on the show. I've interviewed her 3 or 4 times. She's the author of Great Chefs Cook Vegan, as well as Virgin Vegan. And she's been vegan for 41 years. I was blasting to everyone that I'm celebrating my 30th anniversary as being vegan, and there she is at 41 years being vegan. And while it's easy to get frustrated, especially hearing some of the talks during Veggie Pride, where they remind all of us all of the reasons why we want to eat plants and not consume other sentient beings, not consume other animals, they'll remind us about how cruel it is and how it seems to get crueler and crueler, the things that go on in the factory farms with animals. Instead, this is a great time to reflect and see how much good has happened in a relatively short time. 30, 40 years really isn't a very long time. And the growth of veganism in this short amount of time has been exponential. And I'm really hoping that now we'll see a tipping point soon where more people will jump on the wagon and it will become so normal and so accessible for vegan products in restaurants and in clothing stores, personal care products, everything. We'll just be so much more aware of how things are made and how we want things made in a sustainable way, in a kind way, and not just with respect to animals, but also with how we treat our fellow human beings. So all of this is good. And I got my 5 minutes of fame where I got to speak. It was interesting this year because there were many more speakers and we were all given 5 minutes, which I think for that sort of event was perfect. Unfortunately, some people didn't stick to their 5 minutes and they went on and on and on, which really didn't help with the vibe, with the energy of the event. But most of us stuck to 5 minutes. I stuck to 5 minutes. And it was just to give people an introduction and a taste of what you are about and what you have to offer if they're curious. My style of activism has changed so much over the last few years. And this year at the Veggie Pride Parade, I stood in front of our table, not behind it. And I did that on purpose because I think it makes people feel more comfortable approaching you, or at least to respond when you approach them. And I would just randomly, I would say to people, "What brings you to Veggie Pride?" And they would tell me. Some people were vegan, and they've been coming for years, but most people were not, or at least if it was a couple. One of the people in the couple was either vegetarian or vegan leaning, and the other was being a compassionate partner and curious, and they were just having a nice time learning and tasting. There were lots of yummy samples of food. I didn't have any of them, but I know they were there. It was a good time. Like many of these events, the ones that I used to host back in the early 2000s when I ran the Taste of Health vegan festival at Lincoln Center. It was always in June, and it was always boiling hot. And people would complain, oh my goodness, it's how hot it is. Can't you do it another time of year when it's not so hot? And then the Veggie Pride Parade has always been in March or April, and it's always freezing. And this has been like the coldest April ever. And it was cold. It wasn't as cold as some of the other Veggie Pride events I've been to, but it chilled us. So by the time I had finished my 5-minute talk, which was around 4 o'clock, we decided to roll up and leave. And there was going to be an event at the V Spot in the East Village later on in that evening, where people from the Veggie Pride Parade could see comedians. They were supposed to all be vegan comedians too. So in between that time, Gary and I decided to warm up. And we went over to Barnes & Noble, which is right across the street from Union Square. I thought we might sit, have some tea, warm up, and just relax. Being inside a bookstore, it just triggered all kinds of thoughts for me. And that's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. We're living in an age of technology. More and more things are accessible online, in that cloud out there. And there seems to be less and less reason to hold things, physical things, like books. And we've seen many bookstores close, many bookstores continue to close, and yet bookstores were often a meeting place, a place for community, a place for dialogue, a place for not only reading books, which is fantastic, but for people to discuss ideas together. There are some bookstores here and there. I know there's a few in Manhattan where they actually have community events. People can come and hear excerpts from a book, a new book, like a book reading from an author. And those things are nice. But when I was standing amongst all of those books at Barnes & Noble, I had a vision, almost. Remember that movie that Jim Carrey was in, where he got to play God for a little while? And he was sitting at his computer, of course, and all of these different thoughts and wishes and prayers were coming into him all at once. And as time wore on, he started to hear them and more and more of them all at once, simultaneously. So many people talking and wishing and praying and wanting. I thought of that in the bookstore. I looked at all of those books and thought about what they represented. People's stories, people's philosophies, wishes, people wanting to help other people, sharing their journeys, their experiences. I could almost hear them. Like in that Jim Carrey movie, it was overwhelming hearing all of those stories and thoughts and people. I don't feel that way when I'm using the internet. And maybe I should, because there's lots and lots of people using the internet. It's not like they're not there. And some people say that Twitter feels that way, where everybody is giving their thoughts and comments every other second. But seeing the physical books there just was powerful for me. And I realized there's so much information out there. You can't possibly know it all and shouldn't even try. But in a bookstore, you can walk around and you can almost feel certain books draw you in, calling you and saying, yeah, let's have a conversation. Let's talk. And that's one of the things I like about a bookstore. There's life there. In a bookstore, very often, we have to look across, look up, look around, as opposed to when we're looking at our phones, which just gives us a slouched over position. We're looking down. I don't know. Am I just getting older and bemoaning the changes in the world? I have books that I have treasured, just like record albums that I have treasured. I'm glad that record albums are making a little comeback for some people. Something about listening to something over and over again, or reading something over and over again, or thumbing through it and feeling it, and going back to those favorite moments, those favorite places, those memories. I'm not quite sure how to do that in cyberspace. Of course, there are many, many benefits to having books online, to be able to use a pad or a Kindle, take many books with you when you're traveling, and be able to read them. I recognize that, and I actually take advantage of those things. And I struggle at home because many different publishing companies send me books, books to talk about with you. And my shelves long ago ran out of space. And I just don't know what to do with all of these wonderful books that I have. I have offered them to libraries and they don't want them. So it's kind of an interesting problem to have. I learned most of everything I know about food from reading books, most of them physical paper books too. And perhaps today people learn more from listening to podcasts. I guess things just keep changing and are dynamic, but my point, there is a point here. Just like the Veggie Pride Parade and just like bookstores, there's information in there. Information that people want to share with other people. And there's an advantage to meeting people face to face at an event like Veggie Pride. And I love the interaction with individuals, looking in their eyes and sharing their opinions and stories and sharing a little bit of mine. And then going into a bookstore and seeing a different way to communicate with each other. A different but also valuable and important way. And now we have many, many other methods of communicating. In my 5-minute talk, I touched on the fact that most of us have this information about food and its connection to health, environment, and the treatment of animals. Most people know it. Either they know it because they've heard about it on television, they've read about it in magazines or in books, or they have someone in the family who's vegetarian and vegan and who have shared with the family why they've made that choice to eat the way they do, not eating animals. More television shows and movies include vegetarians and vegans in their stories, some of them positively, some of them not so positively, but people are aware of choices other people are making when it comes to food, and I believe most people know to some degree what's going on. And then my question always is, why isn't everyone becoming vegan? If we know the information, why aren't we making those choices? If we know the information when we hear it face to face from people at events, or we listen to a speaker, or if we go into a bookstore and we read some titles or pick out some books and read them, or if we go on the internet and choose to follow one article or another about the latest horrors in climate change or in factory farming or even in health, the information is out there where people are shown that it's not good for us physically, mentally, spiritually, environmentally, to consume the flesh of other sentient beings or their byproducts. And yet we don't change. And this is what has been puzzling me and fueling me most recently. What is it with all of this information that's available out there? And it's true, There is plenty of information on the internet that says we should be eating animals, so I understand it's confusing. But the information is there. There's something else. There's something else at work. And that something else is that many people, I might even say most people, are struggling in one way or another. Struggling mostly emotionally, struggling financially, struggling physically. And this makes change hard. I remember a quote by Henry David Thoreau, "The massive men lead lives of quiet desperation." I learned it in high school. And it comes back to me from time to time when I think about why people don't choose what's best for them, or at least choose the foods that are best for them and their family and for the planet. It boggles my mind. And then I think of it. People are struggling with many issues. Many, even people who are well-to-do, are struggling. Maybe that's why we're here on Earth. Maybe we're supposed to be here to struggle and figure things out, and that's our journey. When I talk to people now about changing their diet, I'm using a different approach. And it's an approach that encompasses everything that they might be going through in order to find a way that seems safe and comfortable, in order to make a change that is going to benefit them. I read too somewhere that because change doesn't necessarily feel safe, people may want to stay with their current situation, no matter how abusive or unsupporting or frustrating it may be. It feels safer, and so change is not made. I've said it before, it takes courage. It takes courage to change. It takes courage to change what you're eating. No matter how much compelling information there is out there, hearing it from speakers at live events, or getting it from books in bookstores, or searching on the internet and reading article after article after article, the information is out there, but if people don't feel safe about making a change, it's probably not going to happen. So how do we do that? How do we make people feel comfortable and safe about making changes with their food choices? I don't have all the answers. I don't know that I even have any, but I know what I like to do. And I like to think that it works to a certain degree. One thing I like to do is make food and have people over for an event, a party, or even bring food to another party and have people taste the food. Now, it's best if people don't know that it's even vegan and they get to taste it and they love it and then they discover it's vegan, because that way they go into a tasting and they're not subjective. They have an objective palate. But often that's not possible, especially in today's world where people are more concerned about the ingredients in their foods. And actually, I'm kind of laughing about what I just said and thinking that's a whole other topic there, isn't it? Because people don't want to change, but they seem to be more aware about what's in their food. I guess that's a step in the right direction. But I find when people learn that they're not going to be missing anything, that the change isn't going to be an obvious change. Let's say you like to eat a certain food, let's say ice cream, and you can't imagine giving up your ice cream. And then you're given a vegan version of ice cream that isn't dairy-based, but maybe it's made with coconut milk or cashew milk or almond milk or a combination. And you serve it, and they taste it, and they love it, and then you tell them, that's a plant-based food, that's a vegan food, there's no dairy in there, and then their minds are blown. They realize, oh, I won't have to suffer, I won't have to be deprived. I won't have to miss something that brings me comfort in life. This doesn't have to be a change that is so disruptive in my life. I can do this. I can do this one bite at a time. Now, humanity's palate has been changed over the centuries based on where people are, what their needs are, and also by how we've been manipulated. So in the last 100 years, 200 years or so, we've slowly been manipulated into wanting to consume foods, and I say that carefully, foods, put quotes around it, foods that are not necessarily good for us. Industrial foods, for example. And the people that have been making these industrial foods have been getting smarter and smarter, knowing how the human mind works, knowing how the human palate works, to make these foods almost addicting with using sugar, salt, and oils. People more and more want to have their food have a certain sensation from sugar, salt, and oil. And it's addicting almost. The tongue becomes calibrated to crave these certain foods. And even though it's difficult to change, I think many people are less resistant to change when it may imply that you've reached a certain new level of wealth. And a lot of people would like to be wealthy, being able to buy whatever they want, and eating meat and meat byproducts like dairy products and cheese are associated with affluence in the developing world. And I don't like using the term developing, but that's what we do. In some ways, I think some of these countries that don't have the advanced technology that we are spiritually a lot more developed than we are. But in other countries that don't have the technological, quote, advancements that we have, as they develop them and their people have more financial spending power, they want to consume the foods that are related to people who have made it, people who are wealthy. And that includes meat and dairy products, foods that are not healthy, foods that used to be difficult to attain, and now are becoming more accessible. What drives me nuts sometimes is with all this information that's available, talking to people face-to-face, getting them from books, getting them online on the internet, the people who are now having more access to wealth want to spend it on foods that we know are not healthy. We know this. Somehow that information hasn't gotten to them yet. They're still 50, 100 years behind in terms of getting the most important up-to-date nutritional information. It doesn't make sense to me. Another popular way of getting the information out these days uses the internet, and that involves these online conferences. There are more and more of them all the time, and one particular one that I am involved with and I support is the Food Revolution Network's annual summit. And there is one coming up starting on April 29th, and I will be there. My partner Gary and I have created 9 recipes for the summit, and you get a new one every day. It's always a kind of a fun and intense time when we do this. And we just did it this past weekend before the Veggie Pride Parade. We spent 2 or 3 days creating, discussing, shopping, then chopping and preparing and making 9 dishes and then photographing them all, writing the recipes up and sending them over to the Food Revolution Network for review. And then we get to eat everything. So we did a lot of cooking on Saturday, and I barely ate all day. It was amazing. I made all this food, and nothing went into my mouth. But I'm really enjoying the efforts of our labors now. And I wanted to talk about some of the things I discovered in making these recipes. Food has been a journey for me for decades as I learn more about nutrition. And my tastes have changed. My needs have changed. I find it's a very individual thing, what we want to eat. Many of us settle in on a few dishes that we're comfortable with, and we repeat them over and over for those who cook. And then somehow, in my discoveries, something new might creep into my repertoire. And that's fun. And there have been some new things that have been creeping in. Some of these things are so new for me, and then I might be thumbing through an old book or reading an article or listening to something, and I realize other people have been doing this for a long time. It isn't new, but it's new for me in my journey, and I want to share some of those things with you. One of my favorite ingredients these days is sweet potatoes, and I've been doing more and more with sweet potatoes than ever before. So you may or may not know this, but sweet potatoes tend to be a healthier food than a white potato. And I'm not saying avoid white potatoes, but if you're going to compare one with the other, sweet potato hits more bells, rings more bells than white potatoes do. White potatoes tend to be a high glycemic food, and sweet potatoes have more fiber and are slightly lower on the glycemic index. And I just keep discovering more and more things to do with them. I love them. So you may have noticed on the responsibilityandliving.com page, we added a couple of recipes a while back. One was a sweet potato and black bean salad, and another was a sweet potato and black bean soup. A lot of the same ingredients, and you can make something completely different and yummy. But sweet potatoes, I've been adding them to more soups these days because I love the delicate sweetness. And I've been making chunky soups with, usually I make them with a broth, but the broth now is a little thicker, a little richer, a little sweeter, a little creamier, because I might blend a sweet potato in there. Or even if I just cut them up as little chunks, they seem to melt in with the rest of the ingredients so deliciously. So they're a great ingredient that I've been using in soups. And then corn is another one of those. So we buy an organic frozen corn. And I always make sure it's organic because corn, unfortunately, is one of those very popular genetically modified foods. And I know, there's no real guarantee that genetically modified organisms haven't gotten into some of my organic food. But I do the best I can, and I want to encourage those who believe in organic to keep going. And this particular frozen corn is very yummy, and we like to also add it to soups, either whole kernels or blended in, just adding this delicate, yummy sweetness to all of the other flavors. Now, whenever we make soup, we start with the basics, onions, celery, and carrots. These are the aromatics that offer up a lot of wonderful flavor and, of course, nutrition. But I've been adding in some others, like sweet potatoes and carrots, like sweet potatoes and corn, and it's adding a whole new dimension. There are some other foods that are very similar to sweet potato that can be used in the same way, like butternut squash and pumpkin. You can add them to soups and stews for added thickness and sweetness. Fantastic. Sweet potatoes also make great toast. Have you seen this thing going around the internet? It came out, I don't know, a year or so ago, where if you slice sweet potatoes lengthwise, you can pop them in your toaster and make something very similar to toast. And this is a wonderful thing if you want to get off bread, especially breads with refined flours, or maybe you're gluten intolerant or have celiac or an allergy to wheat, you can make a toast-like product with sweet potatoes and cover it with all your favorite spreads. Now, what was originally recommended was to put the sweet potato slices in a toaster, and depending on the kind of toaster you have, this may or may not work very well. But what I found was it was very time consuming, and if you had a bunch of people you wanted to make, quote, toast for, it would take a long time. So what we came up with, and it really isn't that clever, but I love it, is I'll cut up a bunch of sweet potatoes, maybe four or more, depending on how many people I want to serve, and bake them. That way, they're sliced, baked. I don't have to think about them while they're cooking. It takes about a half hour. But you can be doing other things rather than standing at a toaster and waiting to see if it's burning or going to pop out or maybe get stuck or who knows what. And these are wonderful. And once we've baked them, we can store them in a container in the refrigerator and then take them out. Then you can toast them really quickly or warm them up again in the oven. And this is my new toast. I'm totally in love with it. It's great with bananas and peanut butter. I recommend it. Another recent discovery was using fresh turmeric. Now, how many of you have heard how healthy turmeric is? And it's almost full circle for me, and I'll tell you why. So I think I had started using turmeric a long time ago because of its color, not because of its nutritional value. I liked to make tofu scramble, and turmeric is a great ingredient to use, not just because it's good for you, but because it makes the tofu look yellow, so it looks like eggs. And for people that are afraid to try a tofu scramble, if you make it look more like eggs, they feel safer. Remember what I said about making change and feeling safe. It looks more like something they're used to, and they're more apt to be open and objective about trying it. So I would add turmeric to my tofu scrambles and use it that way. And then at some point learned that turmeric was really good for you. When I was going through my cancer treatment back in 2006, I took loads of curcumin capsules, which is the important ingredient in turmeric, but it was isolated. And I took high concentrations of it. It's supposed to be an anti-cancer nutrient. But I'm thinking whole has got to be better than extracted. I just believe that in general. I think nature's got a lot of things so figured out, so far ahead of what we know and understand. And I used turmeric powder in so many things. When I went to Costa Rica for my second time, I think it was around 2004, 2005, I visited a farm, and the man who was showing me around his farm showed me fresh turmeric that he was growing. And I tried it a little bit, and I just left it aside. I just forgot about it. I've seen fresh turmeric from time to time in local grocery stores. I even bought it once and didn't do anything with it. Have you ever done that? I know you have, because people tell me all the time. They try and do something good. They try and do something new. They'll buy a food, maybe a bunch of greens, and then it sits there in the refrigerator because we don't know what to do with it, or it doesn't feel safe to try something new. And I had this turmeric, and I just never did anything with it. And then I moved it to the freezer, thinking, okay, maybe it'll stay fresh in there. And ultimately, I just dumped it, which I don't like to do. I rarely waste food. But I was ready this time, and we bought fresh turmeric and incorporated it in a number of new recipes. And I'm hooked. This is an ingredient that I'm going to be using from now on. It's very similar to ginger in the way that you prepare it. Have you ever used fresh ginger? And if you haven't, you absolutely must. That's another big ingredient that we used in our new recipes for the Food Revolution Summit Fresh Ginger. Well, both of them come with a beigeish, grayish brown skin. It doesn't look very appealing when you look at it. It's a root vegetable. And what you need to do is you take the back of a spoon, the edge actually of the spoon, and scrape the skin off. And if it's ginger, what's underneath is a pale yellow, very hot and spicy, fleshy root. And with turmeric, it's this super gorgeous, bright orange that just pops out. It almost looks like a baby carrot. It does not taste like a baby carrot, but it's got its own unique, unusual flavor, slightly bitter, but it's so good for you. And I have to believe that fresh has got to be best. So we've used the turmeric and the ginger together in a ginger turmeric latte. Now, a few weeks ago, we were going to a show and we stopped into the Juice Press, which is a chain of fresh juice and smoothie making store. And they had a new item, or maybe I had never noticed it and it was always there, I don't know, but it was a ginger latte and we both had it. It was fantastic. It was ginger. I think it was a ginger chai latte. It had some chai spices, ginger, almond milk, and a little agave in it. It was warm. It was hot and so wonderful. The ginger just pow, it just wakes you up. It's so energizing. It's great for the brain. And in a creamy, warm base of almond milk, it was just so yummy. And I thought, I need to make this at home. And then we had another one this week. We treated ourselves to a trip to Candle Cafe in Manhattan, another favorite restaurant that's been around for quite some time. I had just had my annual physical and I was feeling good, and we wanted to celebrate the beginning of my birthday month, because my birthday is on Earth Day, April 22nd, and I like to celebrate the entire month. So I was having a ginger latte, and it was very similar to the other ones, and I thought, I'm really liking this blend for a hot drink of a creamy plant milk and this hot, spicy ginger flavor. So good. So we made it at home, and we tried it a few different times. We used a powder, ginger powder and powdered turmeric, because sometimes you just don't have fresh. And then we did it with the fresh. Of course, the fresh tastes so much better, but they're both good. And I'm loving it, and I'm thinking of Bulletproof Coffee. Have you ever tried it? It's a coffee that uses butter. And the idea is that it's supposed to be wonderfully healthy. And the butter gives you some important fats that you need. I've never bought into it, but a lot of people love it because a lot of people love their coffee. And I've read so many different things about coffee. There are articles that say coffee can be health promoting. There are articles that say that it is not. And most recently, I've heard that it's best not to consume coffee every day because your body actually gets used to its effect and drops your whole, and your peak of energy actually drops, your average energy actually drops, so that you feel like you need coffee just to get back up to where you naturally would be. And so the recommendation is to get the benefits that have been seen with coffee. You should really cycle coffee on and off so that your body doesn't get used to its energizing, quote, energizing effects. Whatever. I have not drunk coffee in a very, very long time, and I particularly don't promote it. But I'm thinking, with this bulletproof coffee that people love. They love the creaminess with the coffee, and they love the feeling of getting the stimulation. So we made a ginger turmeric latte. It's made with coconut milk. You can use any plant milk, but I find that the coconut milk is the fattiest and the creamiest and the yummiest. Fresh ginger, fresh turmeric. And if you like it sweet, because some people will find the intense flavors of ginger and turmeric just a little too much and want to smooth it out a little bit, you can blend in some dates. It's easy to make, and it's really yummy. You can make a bunch up and then warm it up every day as your morning latte. And it's just so much better than a stimulation from coffee with butter in it, which is loaded with cholesterol and saturated fat. You don't need these foods, no matter how much they say. I haven't seen any studies that show that bulletproof coffee drinking on a regular basis is something that is good for you. But consuming a ginger turmeric plant milk latte definitely has health-promoting benefits to it. So I encourage you to try it. I'll be posting these recipes that I'm talking about on the Responsible Eating and Living website sometime after the Food Revolution Summit. We're going to introduce them at the Food Revolution Summit. And if you're interested in participating and listening to the lectures, there are 3 speakers every day for 8 days. And then the last day, John and Ocean Robbins sum up the event. I know it's hard for some people to set aside the time for something like this. And that's why they offer a package that you can purchase where you can get to hear the speakers at your convenience. But there is something about making a commitment to focus on a particular subject in a short amount of time. And you feel part of a community. There's a lot of people that are chatting on the broadcast page, giving their comments, and people are responding. People ask questions. I'm there to answer those questions, and other people in the community give their answers as well. Another dish we made is a mushroom chorizo. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with chorizo, if you've ever had it before, but it's a Spanish or Mexican dish. It's typically made with pork, and it's highly, highly spiced, and it can be made into a dry sausage, or it can be in a softer form. And I've made a variety of vegan versions of chorizo over the years. I used to use a textured vegetable protein, or a gimme lean product, which is a soy version of chopped meat or ground beef, however you call it. The trick to chorizo is a ton of spices. This is a very highly spiced dish. So I made it with mushrooms this time, mushrooms and walnuts. It's really yummy. And it can be used as a stuffing. It can be used as a filler in tacos. And it looks like a crumbled brown mass. Now, that may not sound appealing to you, but it looks like what meat looks like. And if you described sometime what a ground beef would look like, I don't know if it would sound appealing, would it? I remember when I was a teenager, really young, I went to Jack in the Box, that fast food place, and they had tacos. Have you ever eaten there? I don't know what their tacos look like today because I haven't been there in decades. But the taco had this small little lump of seasoned something. I know it was meat-based, but it was this ground-up, oily plop. And it didn't look appetizing at all. And we ate it. We were kids. It was highly seasoned. It had oil and salt in it. Made it easy to go down. And when I think about something like chorizo, it has that, not that same look as the one at Jack in the Box, but it has that look of something that's been mashed out of recognition and then tons of spices have been added back into it. Was that originally to make it palatable? I don't really know. But what I like about this mushroom chorizo, of course, there's no oil in it, there's no salt in it, there's no artificial sweeteners or sugars in it. It's just some wonderful spices, mushrooms, and walnuts. But you can still taste the mushroom in it, which is nice if you like mushrooms. My partner Gary does not like mushrooms, and he will not be having any of the mushroom chorizo. Another dish that I'm so crazy excited about is a spaghetti squash dish that's tossed with fresh tomatoes, basil, and garlic in a balsamic vinegar dressing. Spaghetti squash is another one of those foods I've known about for a long time and just never really got into it to include it regularly in my repertoire. But now I'm realizing this is really a fun food that can be very, very delicious and super easy to make. I don't do anything to it other than just wash the outside skin a little bit and then just put it on a sheet pan in the oven and cook it for an hour. I don't wrap it in anything. I don't cover it in anything. I don't cut it open. Nothing. I take the entire whole squash, just kind of clean off the outside and pop it in the oven. That is all. You can cook it at 400 degrees Fahrenheit for about an hour and then carefully check to see that it's soft by just gently putting a little pressure on the skin. If it isn't, cook it a little more. It's not going to harm anything. And then when it's done, you take it out, let it cool a little bit. Then you can cut it open. It's easy to cut now that it's cooked and soft. Otherwise, when you try and cut it open when it's hard, oh, it's hard because it's hard. Once it's cooked, you can open it up, carefully remove the seeds, and then gently scoop out the spaghetti. And it's perfect. It's al dente perfect. Perfect texture. It's got a nice chew because of the fiber that comes with it, because it's a plant food and not an industrialized, refined, manufactured food like most pastas are. And it's so much fun to toss with your favorite sauces. You could toss it with a jar of your favorite marinara, for example, or create a creamy cashew cheese sauce if you like. You could do whatever you like to do with pasta. So we made a very fresh basil, fresh garlic, fresh tomatoes, with a little balsamic vinegar. Absolutely spectacular. And as I mentioned before, we're getting to eat these dishes for the next few days, which is the bonus, the treat. And they all last a few days. You can make some of these things in advance. For example, the spaghetti squash. You could cook the squash. You could transfer the, quote, spaghetti into a dish and cover it and refrigerate it. You can prepare whatever sauce you want. I wouldn't mix them together until you're ready to serve. And then reheat the squash and serve it with the sauce. And it's done. It's spectacular. And it's so colorful. All of those foods. The spaghetti squash is a lovely yellow. If you make, keep the basil coarse chopped so that the green doesn't mix in with everything else and you just see the bright green leaves of the basil. It's just fantastic. And then there's a really fun smoothie. I say it's fun because it's super easy using frozen spinach. So a lot of times when I make smoothies, and I make some pretty intense, nutritious, sludgy kind of smoothies, I like to use fresh greens. But then you have to rinse them and chop them, and there is some labor involved. But if you want to do something really quick, use frozen spinach. Frozen spinach, frozen blueberries, a little plant milk, and I like to add cocoa powder. You can add cocoa powder or raw cacao nibs. And then if you need it to have a little sweet taste to it, you can add some dates or a banana if you like. And it's super, super fast. Using the frozen spinach is just genius. And depending on the blender that you have, if you have a high-powered blender and you don't add a lot of plant milk, it can almost be like a soft serve. This time I made a smoothie with it. And the real delicious part of it was using stainless steel straws. So the idea of using plastic straws is trending quite a bit. I'm sure you've heard about how they are wreaking havoc on the environment. There's a huge movement to stop using plastic straws. But I guess not everybody's hearing it because I've ordered a bunch of different things lately in restaurants that have still served plastic straws. Change is hard, isn't it? We bought a couple of stainless steel straws a while back, and it came with its own adorable little brush that's slim enough to go inside of each individual straw and scrub it up. And they're wonderful. They go really well with this particular smoothie. The silver color of the stainless steel goes with the bluish, purplish, brownish color from the spinach and the blueberries. I call it blue steel. I almost forgot, but we made a red cabbage salad. And one thing I like about these hardier leaves, like kale and collards and cabbages, is you can make a salad and dress it and it won't wilt. So it lasts for a few days and it's a great dish that you can take to a potluck or a picnic or an event and it holds up. In fact, it even gets better as the dressing marinates in the salad itself. The salad we made for the Food Revolution Summit this year is a red cabbage salad with a lemon mint dressing. So simple and so good. I can't believe I've never done this before, but I will be doing it many, many times. I don't know if you've had Chinese chicken salad, the real version with chicken, or the vegetarian and vegan versions, but it's basically a shredded cabbage salad. There might be some other vegetables in it, and it's got either peanuts in it or almonds in it. Sometimes they put in a fried little noodle, and it'll have some onions or scallions. But the sauce tends to be like a rice vinegar, something tart. Sometimes lemon is used, and then it's sweetened with sugar. Meh, meh, meh. And there are some restaurants that I still go to and they have their vegan versions of the Chinese chicken salad and you can taste the sweetness. So that, and I'm sure that sweetness is either from sugar or maybe from agave or something like that. We use dates and it's perfect. The blend of the lemon and the mint and the dates is addicting. It's fantastic. It's fresh and wonderful and then tossed with the red cabbage is fantastic. In fact, I want to have some right now. Just a few more minutes, and I will. We've got a few more recipes for the Food Revolution Summit, but you'll have to register and participate in order to find out more about them. And I hope you do. So there'll be a link on the Responsible Eating and Living site, my nonprofit website, that you can link to in order to find out more about the upcoming Food Revolution Summit for 2018. There are many, many wonderful speakers, and of course it's hosted by Ocean Robbins, and John Robbins interviews all of the speakers, and he's just so good. In the meantime, I'm taking off for Costa Rica, and I'm going to be celebrating my 60th birthday in Costa Rica. And I'm not quite sure if I will be preparing some new broadcasts while I'm there. If not, I'll see you in a few weeks. But I will always be available via email. You can contact me at info@realmeals.org. And visit Responsible Eating and Living. You can follow my blog, What Vegans Eat. I will be posting every day, as I always do, and I will be posting about my adventure in Costa Rica while I'm there. One of the things that I love about going there are the wonderful fruits, and I can't wait to live on papaya and mangoes and avocados and pineapples and all the other ones whose names I don't know, but we'll learn again, as I always do when I'm there. I can't wait. So until next time, everybody, have a very delicious time. Bye-bye. Thank you.